This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome to the gathering, Junkions. It is, of course, time for Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. Dot living forever. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, as always, as across all of the ages, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, he's a screenwriter, he's a lieutenant of Megaforce, he's in league with the Kurgan, he's C. Robert Cargill.
Hi, laddie.
I guess I could.
It'd be a fine time for a bad accent.
Especially if you're selling sugary marshmallow cereal, apparently. To throw shade on the accent, I'm just saying.
I am so happy about this week. This is the type of movie that I was exactly hoping for when we talked about January, in which we've been meaning to cover this for years.
Yes.
We talked about this when we initially lobbed out 50 movies we wanted to talk about.
Hundreds of years ago.
And for some reason, here we are almost 4 years into the show and we still haven't fucking covered Highlander. And today we rectify that mistake.
Before we start talking about this immortal classic, or at least this classic about immortals, let's do a little bit of housekeeping. This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast. So good, it just has to be fattening. And how can you prove that for yourself? Well, you can check out our back catalog on Blog Talk Radio Network. You can also find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. We are on iTunes. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And of course, if you really like the show, if it's something that really tickles you, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. And for as little as a dollar per episode, if you throw at least that many shekels into the hat, you will get access to content that nobody else gets to hear, that we do exclusively for you guys as a way to show our appreciation for you keeping the lights on here throughout all time. And I want to, before we go any further, I just want to throw a special shout out to a listener named Alex, who we unfortunately, I was informed, is battling cancer at the moment. And we just wanted to, before we went any further, just kind of reach out and let you know that we're behind you, and we hope that, you know, the fight is going well, and we are definitely in your corner. Thank you for being a junkie on, and we're pulling for you, and just we wanted to express our love and support. So Alex, thank you so much for being a listener, and we're behind you all the way.
And fuck cancer.
Fuck cancer. Fuck cancer and fuck Kurgans. That's what we have said since day one. By the way, C. Robert Kurgan would be a really cool mashup cosplay for Convergence. If you haven't come up with one yet this year, Cargill, it's basically just you with your backwards hat, but then you're also carrying a giant broadsword and kind of dressed like Randall Tex Cobb from Raising Arizona.
You know, to really do that, I'd have to do the safety pins all the way around the neck.
Man, that really casts aspersions on the word safety in the name safety pin, when it's what's holding your head onto your neck. Also, technicality, I feel, the rules of the immortals, how is that not a kill? You know, it's like LARPing. I feel like the first time that happened, it probably should have been a kill. I think he squeaked away with one.
Which one are you talking about?
When he goes up against Ramirez and he gets that cut through the neck, and
we'll get there.
It's so severe that he has to hold it on with fucking safety pins. It's like, I feel like that should have counted.
He's not holding it on with safety pins at all. Like, he has no problem with that at all. That's just in his disguise. But we'll get there in the story. Like, you just literally jumped ahead to, like, at the end of Act Two.
And hey, I'm jumping around in time, much like the movie The Highlander does.
From another time comes a man of great power.
Talk funny, Nash. Where are you from?
Lots of different places. A warrior of incredible strength.
You've the devil in you.
We've been kinsmen 20 years.
Connor MacLeod was my kinsman.
I don't know who you are.
Because you were born different, men will fear you, try to drive you away.
And haunted by his past.
Ah! Ah!
Wait a minute, Nash. I want some answers.
In the end... there can be only one.
Highlander, there can be only one.
And here we are!
Oh, hell yes it does.
Yes it does.
This movie is delightfully all over the map. First of all, I adore the hell out of this movie. I really love it. And one of the things that even Brian did not know is just how big of a Highlander nerd I was growing up. I remember discovering this on videotape right after it came out. My dad brought it home as one of our Saturday night movies. I haven't actually really talked about this over the course of the podcast. When I grew up, my parents are big movie lovers too. And, I am far bigger of a movie nerd than they are, but they really did kind of seed my love of movies. And when I was growing up, they had family night, and family night we did every Saturday night. We made homemade pizza and we rented a movie and we watched a movie. And there were things that I didn't put together until later in life, like the fact that there was a reason why I'd seen every Star Trek movie on the day that it opened, as my dad was a much bigger Star Trek nerd than I imagined. And, they would grab all sorts of crazy genre stuff that would come out. And my dad saw this movie Highlander on the video shelf the weekend it came out. And he's like, oh, we have to check this out. It was not big when it came out. It was essentially, as several people I knew at the time had seen it as the third movie at a drive-in theater. Like, it was the midnight movie. It was an indie film that just really took off. And for some reason on video, not only did it find its audience, holy shit, did it find its audience. Like, this is a movie that spawned three more theatrical releases. I'm not going to call them sequels because one of them kind of isn't, and we'll get into that. A TV show, a spinoff from that TV show, and a kid's cartoon.
Much in the vein of cartoons based on movies for kids that should not have cartoons based on them.
Oh, yeah. And we've talked about that a couple times. Like, in the late 80s, like, there was, you know, we had a Rambo cartoon show, a RoboCop cartoon show.
Toxic Avenger.
A Toxic Avenger cartoon show. Like, there's some really fucked up stuff from the 80s. Like, I'm always baffled at the fact, when I think back, that 10-year-old Cargill had a 12-inch tall... Vietnam War vet with PTSD and a 12-inch tall Colonel Troutman to send him off into my backyard to fight the Vietnamese. Like, the very fact that that was a thing in my life just baffles the shit out of me. Like, how did we get there as a society?
I'd buy that for a lifetime of therapy.
It's just kind of fucked up. But Highlander really had this immersion for a while. In fact, in the early 90s, there was the big role-playing game that destroyed Dungeons & Dragons. Dungeons & Dragons was, you know, on its last legs. It killed TSR, which would not be sold to Wizards of the Coast until 1998. And what dominated the role-playing game market was Vampire the Masquerade and its offshoots, the World of Darkness games. Well, there was, for those of you who were online in the early 90s, there was a rule set, a fan rule set that someone had made up for Immortals, so that you could play the Immortals from the Highlander game in the World of Darkness. And several of us played a Highlander campaign through the 90s.
I feel my virginity growing back as we go further down this rabbit hole.
It is. I was into it. I really dug the hell out of Highlander, and it is a series that I have loved, despite the fact that at the end of the day, there should be only one. There should be only one Highlander anything. As much as I have, I saw 2, 3, and 4 in theaters. 4, by the way, doesn't count. This is how weird, for those of you that don't know how weird Highlander gets, the second film, there are two functionally different cuts of it. There's Highlander 2, which is garbage. And then there's Highlander 2, the Renegade cut, which makes a sensible movie out of it that's still not any good.
Just because it makes sense now doesn't make it good.
Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice, director's cut does the same thing. It's like, oh, this makes sense now. I still don't like it. But damn it, this is an actual movie this time around. Then the third film is,
by the
like,
way, bravo for clearing low bars. This is a movie now.
It's a movie now. Then the third movie is like, oh, hey, remember, we found a loophole. Somebody came up with a really cool loophole. What if Mario Van Peebles was also an immortal, but he was trapped in ice, so technically dead. So at the end of, you know, the first movie, when we have the finale, technically that could still happen, and there could still be another immortal out there. Also garbage. And then the fourth movie is not actually a sequel to the Highlander movies, despite starring Christopher Lambert. It is actually the theatrical end of the TV series, which Christopher Lambert stars in as his own character, but in what is essentially, as the people who ran the show at the time said, was an alternate universe what if.
It's bullshit. what you're describing, it's also referred to as bullshit.
It's also bullshit. So no, because in Highlander canon, the TV show and the movie series are alternate universes. They do not coincide. And Christopher Lambert eventually shows up in the TV series as a cousin to Duncan MacLeod. And we find out there are two immortals in the MacLeod family.
He's Duncan MacLeod. Lambert's Connor MacLeod. And I want to say something about
this. Phil McCracken, Scottish therapist.
There's... I want to say one thing about that TV show. I watched way more of that television series than any college freshman ever should have, because I would come home from class and USA bought all of the episodes and just had them running all damn day long. So I would sit there and literally with like whatever food I got from the cafeteria, just watch reruns of the Highlander TV show. And
I think it was a USA show, if I remember correctly. Oh, okay.
Well, I would sit there and watch it. And I remember being one of the few people when they were on the hunt for the new James Bond after Brosnan was out, heard the rumor that maybe Adrian Paul was going to be the new James Bond, and was like, oh, fuck yeah, that would be awesome.
No.
No, it wouldn't have been.
No, it would not have been.
But
awesome.
In an alternate universe, it still wouldn't have been awesome, yeah, as it turns out. But yeah, no, but I didn't even know they had a spinoff. So what the fuck is Raven about?
I think it's called Raven. I want to say that's what it was called.
It's about the youngest daughter from the Cosby Show, but now she's an immortal.
No, it was about one of the female characters who was in the Highlander show. Spun off her own show, which got one or two seasons, and it wasn't very good. Like, I mean, that's the thing, is the Highlander TV show wasn't great to begin with, but every week it was, you know, Duncan MacLeod taking the head off of someone else. So that was always kind of
fun. The decapitation of the week.
And it really kind of was.
And it boasts the honor of the lead singer of the Fine Young Cannibals playing a villain. So
yeah,
there's that.
It was actually a really cool concept for a show. In fact, if there was, like, I don't want, like, they've been trying to get the movie rebooted for a long time. And I think if you're going to reboot anything, you reboot the show. Because what's interesting about the show is you're constantly meeting people who have had hundreds or thousands of years of life. And what did they choose to do with it? And that's always interesting. And how they end up, because some of them end up pretty cool fucking dudes, even in this movie. And we'll get to that. And others, you know, are demonstrably evil because we need lots of antagonists. That would be an interesting show to reboot. If you were going to reboot that series in any way, that's the way you fucking do it. Because to remake the movie, you're just remaking this classic film and you would just want to restructure it differently. But we'll get into that. Hey, why not now?
Yeah, we've been talking about Highlander for about 15 minutes without actually talking about the movie. I think this kind of lack of focus is why we are the artists formerly known as the princes of the universe. We really need to get that status back.
The this episode also ties into a number of things we've done recently.
And are about to do.
And are about to do.
In the very near future.
Yes. There might be more Sean Connery coming.
It's entirely possible.
Okay. Let's just address this now. So, there are three major characters in this movie. One of them is a Scotsman being played by an American-born actor who spent all of his time over in Switzerland and France and so has a French accent. So you have an American-born French-speaking Scotsman. You have an Egyptian by way of
Spain,
played by a Scotsman with a speech impediment. And then you have an American playing a Russian.
This movie has as much cultural cohesiveness as putting a sparrow in the Forbidden City in China.
It's really, you have to, that's the one thing you have to really excuse about this movie, is none of the accents make any a lick of goddamn sense.
Christopher Lambert sounds like he has a mouthful of escargot all of the time in this movie. No idea what the fuck he's saying. At all.
And I love how they address that, where they're like, that's an interesting accent. Where's it come from? Where do you come from? He's like, oh, all over. And it's like, you know, maybe these guys would have these really fucked up accents from speaking like 80 languages over the course of 400 years.
She is my bunny lass. It's like, no.
kiss my bunny ass? What the? I don't know what you're saying.
No. Mr. Lambert wants to drink from his bunny glass. Someone get his bunny glass. On set, right? Those poor PAs on this movie, between swords almost accidentally killing actors and...
Could you imagine for one moment...
Oh, I'd like to.
If, for some reason, two fiery actors like Christopher Lambert and Sean Connery got into a spat on the set and started cursing each other out in their native accents.
Oh, no one would have a clue what was happening. You would need a Rosetta Stone to settle that argument.
One of the most amazing moments in the history of mankind.
And they're both probably drunk. So on top of everything, they're both drunk. I love this. I want to be a fly on the wall on this particular production.
So yeah, as we said, Sean Connery, Christopher Lambert, of course, the third leg of this awesomeness fucking tripod is Clancy motherfucking Brown.
Clancy Brick Shithouse Brown.
If you, for some reason, have not seen this movie, you do not truly know why children of the 80s fucking love Clancy Brown. Like, this is literally, there are three performances that he did over the course of, I want to say, 9 years that cemented him as just one of the great character actors. Of course, it's Buckaroo Banzai, and it's Shawshank Redemption. And between those three very different roles, he just became known as that go-to badass that you get whether you need an antagonist or a sidekick or what have you. Of course, a lot of people know him as one of the best Lex Luthors ever to Lex the Luthor. he is to the animated Lex Luthor what Mark Hamill is to the Joker.
Like, now I just want to Lex the Luthor fantastic. Is that an expression? Let's go out and Lex the Luthor fantastic.
It needs to be.
Coined.
And here, he is fucking amazing as the Kurgan. Like, the thing is we joke about all these accents because we have to, because it's the one thing that sticks out like a sore thumb. Everybody here is operating... They're firing on all cylinders. Like, everyone is great in this movie. Sean Connery is delightful as fucking Ramirez.
He is referred to as a Spanish peacock by Connor McLeod. If ever there was a better line of dialogue to sum up an entire presence in a movie, it's that, because he really is a giant Spanish peacock,
yeah.
Despite the fact that he is inescapably Scottish in this movie.
Oh, yes. Scottish as fuck. And Christopher Lambert is really great in this. He broods perfectly. He hits all the points. The reason why there's so much direct-to-video and low-budget just crap from the late 80s, early 90s, starring Christopher Lambert, is entirely off of the popularity of his turn as Connor McLeod.
I'm racking my brain trying to think of another franchise where the first one was so good that it inspired sequels and spinoffs and all these things that are 90% trash, but the legacy of the first film is so good that you kind of, you have some kind of love for all of it, despite the fact that you know most of it is trash.
There's lots of those, actually. I mean, it's most horror movies are that way, you know, that spinoff.
But I guess the problem is I'm so blinded by my love for these things that I, like, you're right. Friday the 13th is probably a great example, but I'm like, no, most of those, some of those are very good, but the fact is they're probably not.
Yeah. No, I mean, not to, God, I'm going to pull off a scab here, but I mean, I was talking about this math a few weeks ago, but Star Wars is a lot that way. Hmm. Star Wars is amazing. Empire is great. We argue over Jedi. Then there are two made-for-television Ewok movies, which are unwatchable. There are three special editions that were in theaters that are loathed. There are three prequels, which are reviled by anyone who wasn't a child when they came out. And Jason Murphy. And now people are having constant arguments over the new ones. Like, it's one of those things where there's a lot of debate there for the quality of the Star Wars films. And oddly enough, in China, where theatrical presentation just became a huge market over the last 10 years, the Star Wars movies aren't performing well because these people didn't grow up with the original Star Wars movies, so they don't have that cultural attachment to it. So they're looking at the films as they're getting them, and they're like, oh, we don't like these. Like, Last Jedi just had a 92% drop-off for its second weekend, which is absurd.
In China.
They're already yanking it out of theaters because the Chinese are like, yeah, we don't like this. It's weird.
Kind of like the drop-off that Matt Damon's The Great Wall experienced, and no one's surprised.
in no surprise at all. It's so weird how much they got out of this one film before it finally petered off and everybody got kind of tired of it. I mean, the last thing to come out for it was in, what, 99 or 2000 with Endgame?
Yeah, I think that's right.
I think 99 was when Endgame came out. And I remember I saw it in the theater because I'm like, fuck, it's a Highlander movie. It's going to suck, but fine. You've got my money. You put Highlander on a poster. I'm here.
Which, by the way, they've been trying to get that reboot off the ground for many years now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I know a bunch of people I know in the industry have been approached, and most of them just don't want to touch something that's sacrosanct like that. You know, one thing we have not mentioned yet
is a lot of this movie so far. We haven't mentioned a lot of this movie so far.
There's a lot of this movie. Brian, who directed this movie?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that, because it's Russell McKay, who is a legend of junk food cinema, if for no other reason than his work in his native Australia, because Razorback.
Well, even before Razorback, I mean, the thing is, I love Russell Mulcahy. He is one of those directors that had this great window of time that's just so amazing. He directed a ton of music videos in the early 80s, a lot of stuff that you know. You would see the videos and be like, oh, that's a classic video. It's like, yeah, that was Russell Mulcahy. And he spun all that success off into making what we here at Junk Food Cinema consider to be one of the best Ozploitation films ever made, Razorback, which, of course...
I'm sorry, what movie?
Razorback.
What?
Razorback.
Razorback. Okay, now I know what you're talking about.
Which, of course, is written by Everett DeRoche, who's one of my favorite screenwriters, and you guys have heard me speak about many times. And he would then go on to spin the success of that into another super low budget movie written by a guy as his college thesis, his graduating thesis. Guy was going to USC named Gregory Wyden. And he would write this as his thesis. There would be interest in it. It was made as a low-budget film. He would then go on to write Backdraft, Take a Drink, Junkies, because Backdraft, definitely a future episode. Amazing Kurt Russell film that I just saw in 35 last year again, and that really holds up, so we'll definitely be talking about that.
Part of me hopes we can hold out to the year 2021 and do a summer of 91 and just talk about like all of these movies, because I've actually been discovering the like filling in some gaps from 91. And what I've been discovering is, oh my God, there's a lot of really great little gems from 91, like on top of the ones you already know about.
91 was the last year that had something really going on before the Hollywood system really started scrambling, trying to figure out what it was doing. And the indie boom happened, because the indie boom really exploded in 1992. And 91 was a good year for Hollywood films. And 92 really wasn't. Summer of 89, by the way, write this down, never going to happen on this show. Summer of 89 is the worst summer in the history of cinema. It is just garbage week in and week out. But 91 is great. But yeah, so Greg Wyden wrote Backdraft and also wrote and directed a film called Prophecy. The Prophecy, not Prophecy, by the way. The Prophecy. Prophecy.
Devils, not bears.
Yes. Prophecy is a mutant bear movie starring Armand Desante as a Native American from 1979.
I can't wait for somebody at Amazon to be like, why all of a sudden are we seeing a boom in people buying Prophecy on DVD? You're welcome.
I actually bought that on VHS. Remember back in the days when they would have like the video stores would have like boxes get damaged and stuff, and they just sell the tape.
Yep.
And they wouldn't have the box. I found Prophecy for $2 in there, and I was like, oh my God, it's the Prophecy. I'm a huge Gregory Wyden fan. And I take it home, and I'm like, what the happy horse fucker is this?
I'll tell you what happened. You got a Santaid, which is a reality show that I'm actually pitching to True TV, so patent pending, nobody steal that idea.
I did get a Santaid pretty hard.
That's actually a Sante and battery at that point.
Yeah, yeah. If you ever want to know how good a film Alien is, sit down and watch Alien back to back with a film that came out a few weeks afterwards called Prophecy, and directed by God, who did Prophecy?
William. Not Friedkin. But
no, it's not Friedkin.
Frankenheimer.
Frankenheimer. Yeah, it was Frankenheimer. It was like somebody who should have known better. it's somebody way too good to make a film with Armand Desante starring as a Native American. Like that is that movie's a thing. It is a thing worth checking out. Crazy junkies.
Take a drink.
Maybe. I need to revisit it. I don't know.
In a month, that'll be titled Someone Should Have Known Better.
Someone Should Have Known Better. Greg Wyden did those three things. And I actually ran into him at a film festival. He was at QT5 back when Quentin Tarantino used to come to town and bring a bunch of his 35 prints and show movies for 10 days. And Greg Wyden came to that and ended up meeting him and hanging out with him for several days. And he talked a lot about, because I asked him about, you know, various Highlander stuff. And he made a living off of collecting checks for something he didn't work on ever again. Like he's like, he told his story. He came up with this really cool story and he told it and he was done. And then the checks kept coming in. He told me this. He told me about his favorite Highlander experience separated from the first film was the studio sent him the script to Highlander 2. And he was like, oh, fuck this, and threw it on the coffee table. And his roommate's like, you're not going to read it? And he's like, no, I'm not going to. I don't want to know what they did to my fucking movie. And his roommate's like, well, can I read it? And he's like, yeah, sure. So his roommate goes to the other side of the apartment and is reading it. He's in his room reading. And just out of the blue, he hears, they're aliens? And that's how Greg Wyden found out just how bad Highlander 2 fucked up his mythology.
10 minutes later, he's like, he's a Native American? What am I reading?
It was, and I, to this day, that is my favorite story of any screenwriter finding out how things have diverged
from
their properties. But I was like, are you upset? He's like, Dude, every time I open my mailbox, they've decided to start a cartoon show or some spinoff show, and I get my royalty checks, and, you know, one movie that I wrote in college has been paying my rent for 15 years, so what do I care?
Much like the Immortals, the residual checks never die. That's a sweet gig. That's where you want to be. That's a nice little wheelhouse to fall into.
It is, and that kind of thing doesn't really exist that much anymore. Like, it's, the way things are written in this day and age, the contracts are written, you don't get the massive kind of residuals off that kind of stuff. And plus, there isn't, you know, the secondary market the way. Like, I mean, Highlander is still in print. Highlander is a movie that once DVD came out, it was one of the first things put on DVD and has never been out of print. Like, it is just one of those movies that every format ever, it's one of the first movies put out on, and then just doesn't leave print.
And I also want to mention a couple more Take a Drink moments, because we've talked about a potential redemption for The Shadow, which is a movie I really love. And of course, a movie I just discovered the other day that abso-fucking-lutely Take All the Drinks, Ricochet,
oh, yeah,
with John Lithgow and Denzel Washington, because damn.
We may have to do a Denzel Watching-thon. Like, I was talking with Joe Lynch when he did, because he had just discovered Ricochet the other night on Twitter. He was talking about it, and there's a whole mess of movies that Denzel has done that we keep saying we're going to do. And it's like, maybe we should do that. Maybe we should do a month of like Ricochet and Virtuosity.
Oh,
and,
hell yes.
Devil in a Blue Dress. And, of course we keep talking about Crimson Tide, which I have seen a zillion-y fucking times.
and props to our friend Greg, who actually programmed a Denzel Watchathon at the Alamo Drafthouse recently.
Called the Denzel Watchathon.
The Denzel Watchathon. So, yeah, we're definitely going to have to kind of piggyback off that. Probably have Greg on for at least one of those movies to talk about.
Oh, probably. He loves Devil in a Blue Dress.
Well, there you go. And I'm sure if he is a red-blooded, oxygen-breathing human, he loves Ricochet, because Ricochet, motherfuckers.
Yeah. I love that you just found that yourself.
I've tried to make more of an effort for discoveries this year. And hi, guys. Welcome to the sidebar. We've been here for a few while.
let's tie the sidebar together. There is a crazy scene in Ricochet in which John Lithgow goes totally Highlander with a sword fight in prison.
Against Jesse Ventura.
It is so this is where the thought process went. If all of a sudden you're like, wait, did I skip a beat in this episode?
It's like a movie.
This is where the headspace is coming
from. It's like a movie written by my uncontrollable id. It's like everything I've ever wanted in a movie just happens. It's great.
Well, we'll cover that later. Let's get back to Highlander.
And here we are, we're the princes of the universe.
Let's do get back to Highlander. This movie...
The Gathering.
This movie starts off... Wait, Highlander... Highlander, is it your collectible card game, Highlander the Gathering?
Yes.
Tap the sword to activate. Now I just really want a Highlander collectible card game.
There was one.
What?
The fucking 90s had everything. Yes, there was a Highlander collectible card game. It wasn't good.
I need pictures.
Fucking had it, but it wasn't good.
If any of you have remnants of this game, I need to see pictures on Twitter immediately.
I'm pretty certain all of the artwork was photos from the show and maybe a couple of the movies.
Oh, man, I got the lead singer from Fine Young Cannibals. I already got like three of him. Damn it. This drives me crazy.
Fighting for survival.
I think we should talk about the fact that this movie starts off at a wrestling match, and you know, because you've probably been following the marketing, that this movie is about a group of immortals that walk the earth, and they exist to battle each other because eventually all of their power has to be held by one of them. All of this shared life force that they have.
Called the quickening.
Yes, which causes a quickening once one of them loses their head and spreads out to the other. It's very much, it was ripped off later in a great fashion by the Jet Li movie, The One.
Yeah, except that Highlander, it wasn't the original type of story to do this kind of story. It was the first, like, mainstream film to do this kind of a story where you kill someone and take their power. But this, there are so many myths and bits of folklore throughout history that have had this idea.
Right. Instead of eating the heart, you take the head.
Yeah. You take the head and you siphon out all the quickening. And as you get more and more quickening in these bodies, crazier and crazier shit happens when the quickening is released.
You ever have a day at home by yourself with nothing to do and you think, man, this would be a great day for a quickening. Just going to take my pants off and have a quick quickening.
Have a quickening?
Yeah.
Yeah. The reason I mentioned this as Highlander the Gathering, one of the other small little things about this movie, again, first of all, I love this movie implicitly.
So good.
Implicitly.
So good.
But for a movie where all the immortals left on Earth get together in New York City to duke it out, there's only five fucking left in this movie. Yeah. Like, really? And we don't even meet all five of them.
It sounds like
one of them has died off screen,
yeah,
and there are four left.
It does kind of sound like we've been invited to the party late.
Very late. That's why the show was such a good idea, where it's like, oh, let's set the show several years before the gathering, so that way we can meet all these other immortals and have some long-running villains and then have people whose heads we take off every episode. It'll be great. But yeah, we only get to meet four in this movie in this timeline. Of course, you know, we have some flashbacks. But yeah, there are only five that show up to New York for the gathering for a big, huge prophecy. They really wrote a prophecy for only five dudes.
Well, you know, one of those five dudes was Armand DeSante, and one of those immortals was a giant bear. So, I mean, I think that's really why the prophecy came to play in New York the way that it did.
Technically six if you count three, which nobody does.
Most people don't count.
Sorry, Mario Van Peebles.
Well, you know, I feel like the industry said that a lot to him. Sorry. Sorry. Yeah, we know you wanted to do your own version of, like, Universal Soldier, can call it Solo, which Brian watched about 20 times when he was a kid.
Remember when he was on every talk show promoting that? And he was like, and it's rated PG-13, so you don't have to go solo. That was the tagline that he had on every single talk show. I'm sure if you look it up, somebody's put a montage together. He literally said that in every interview that he did for the movie Solo. So you didn't have to go solo, but nobody went.
Well, in their defense, you also don't have to go solo if you just don't go at all.
That is
so true. Yeah, hearing that kind of makes me want to cut my own head off. That's super embarrassing.
It really was. It was really, really
almost as embarrassing as the fact that future Oscar winner Adrian Brody is in that movie. Yeah, that's a thing that should just stay in the time capsule, and I don't think I'll ever revisit it again. As we said, this movie starts at a wrestling match and, you know, has all of the great trappings of mid-80s wrestling.
Which was not supposed to happen.
I'm sure it wasn't.
No, this ties into something else that we recently did. It was supposed to open at a hockey game.
And interesting.
They couldn't do that, and so they went with the wrestling match. And that was part of the inspiration for Sudden Death, which we recently did, because it was like, because there were people who really had a hankering to do something with a hockey game. So they just couldn't get it to work. So they ended up doing wrestling. And man, if there's one part of this movie that makes me cringe at the 80s, it's
the two guys with mullets walking down in the ring with
It's the Fabulous Freebirds. It's not just guys. It's the Fabulous Freebirds.
Real wrestlers, I take it.
Real wrestlers. Okay. Wearing Confederate flag capes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shit.
Sequined Confederate flag
capes. Sequined Confederate flag. Because if you're going to be racist, you may as well be gay about it.
Yeah, I just realized as I said that, like, the problem isn't the sequence.
The problem is not the sequence.
But it doesn't help.
It really doesn't. And it was kind of like, oh, God, I remember loving the Fabulous Freebirds. I was also, at the time that I watched them, not old enough to realize how awful those capes were. Dear God. And not like, and just tacky, inappropriate.
But then we pan up to the stands and we see Connor McLeod, Christopher Lambert, with his
Clan McLeod.
Of Clan McLeod, with his trademark smug. There's something smug charming about Christopher Lambert in this movie.
Yes.
Like, he just doesn't give a fuck. No. He's just like, I'm over this. I've seen this 1,000 times. I've lived longer than this movie has been thought of. Like, it's just,
that's actually not bad.
Yeah, like that's how he talks. And I have to credit, there's a podcast I listen to called We Hate Movies, and they've talked about several Christopher Lambert movies, and it made me realize that that's exactly how Christopher Lambert sounds in every movie, which is just, I don't fucking care. Let's just shoot it so I can go home.
And also, smug Christopher Lambert in this week's Unfiltered Wife.
Which I can do now. Sorry.
Well, and I'm doing, my wife was like, why is he dressed like McGruff the Crime Dog?
First of all, it's Clan McGruff.
It's McGruff the Crime Dog of Clan McGruff. He's got the white sneakers, the blue jeans. My wife just killed me with that. I was like, oh my God. For years, I thought he looked so badass. And she just ruined Connor McLeod for me.
Only you can take a bite out of cultural appropriation.
But yeah, it's just... Like, if you don't get this guy, just Google it again, and wow, he's McGruff the Crime Dog.
So don't use drugs. No, what's great is he's either McGruff of the Clan McGruff Dog, or he is 10 seconds away from flashing somebody. He is in full-on flasher garb. If you don't see the Levi's on top of those Nikes, you'd be convinced there's no pants. In that situation, he's got a full-on flasher coat going on. Well,
the thing is, what's actually really cool about that, and something that would be a running gag throughout a bunch of the films and TV series, and included in the role-playing game, by the way, is like there's that whole thing where a couple times people ask him to take off his coat, and he won't take off his coat. And of course, every time he pulls out a sword, he slips the sword right back in the coat. Like, the sword just magically disappears into the coat. And it's been kind of like a universe thing that that's one of their magical things, is to be able to tuck a sword away wherever, just to, you know, essentially shove a sword right up their ass and just reach into their coat and I have a sword now.
My favorite thing about being an immortal is flashing people throughout the centuries. I wear trench coats in every era that I come back to, and I call it the quickening. And it's like, oh, he's a creep. He's an immortal creep. Oh, that's too bad. This opening fight, I want to talk about this opening fight, because he ends up leaving the match. He doesn't apparently care about the outcome of the Fabulous Freebirds fight, and he goes to the parking garage where there is another guy just waiting to call him out. And what happens is a sword fight in a parking garage that eloquently hides the fact that the two actors in the fight aren't great at sword fighting. And what they do is they mask that by having them do things like run across the tops of cars, do backflips off these cars. They attach, literally for the production, attached wires to a car battery to the swords so that they would uber spark every time. It's such a great, like, P.T. Barnum distraction from the fact that the actual sword fighting isn't up to par, and you don't care, because by the time it's over, the sprinkler system is going off, so even though it's indoors, it's basically a fight in the rain.
Mulcahy milks every penny he can from this fucking budget. For a low-budget movie that doesn't have a studio behind it, holy shit, does he do some cool fucking shit in here. And there's also some amazing cinematography for a film on this budget.
Hell yeah.
It is shot so well and masterfully that, yeah, no, that is one of the centerpiece sequences of this movie, is that fight scene. And he just, man, like, to remake this movie and get the kind of, presence that he gets from this movie, to get the get it as big as he shot it, you aren't going to make that low budget this in this day and age, even with computers and stuff. You're talking like $50-100 million to make this movie, and a lot of these things don't look cheap. It's just so well orchestrated and so well done, and probably involves a bunch of things that we wouldn't allow stuntmen to do anymore, so also a problem. But yeah, it does. That opening fight scene is just really evocative and really does an amazing job of setting up what this movie is.
And McCloud ends up taking this man's head, and we see the quickening. So immediately it's established that something interesting is going on. And then from there, we see these flashbacks into McCloud's life. We see him fighting the wars on the actual Highlands and experiencing a wound on the battlefield against a giant evil Black Knight who we later find out is the Kurgan.
The Kurgan.
Who is super badass and also an immortal. He suffers what should be a grave wound on the battlefield, but instead of dying, he makes a full recovery, convincing the rest of his clan that he's, which leads the rest of his clan to believe that he is some sort of witch, and they banish him.
That he has the devil in him.
He has the devil in him. And the movie then kind of, I mean, we're getting a sort of like a Scorsese picture where it's like we're here, and then we go back and we tell this story, and we come back. And so we see him throughout the ages as the police are investigating this fight from the beginning of the movie. And John, by the way, John Polito, amazing character actor, worked with the Coens a lot, is one of the cops investigating, you know, and trying to figure out why there's a decapitated body in a parking garage. And this antique dealer is the prime suspect. And we go back and we see that he finds out, Connor McCloud finds out that he is in fact an immortal. And he comes under the tutelage of one Ramirez, his full name, I believe, is... do you remember his full name? It's like Juan Ramirez de Espinoza
McGruff. The 12th.
Look, there were 11 of me before.
Look, he's fucking Ramirez. That's all you need to know. It's Sean Connery. He's Ramirez. Done. Let's move on.
Yeah, and speaking of Halloween costumes we should all aspire to, the outfit he comes riding in on with that hat and that fringy outfit and those gloves, like, yeah, Spanish peacock he may be, but I'll be damned if I don't want that suit myself. So, and again, we bounce back to the present where the Kurgan is trying to track down McCloud, and we realize that this gathering is happening, and the last of the immortals, and you know, whoever ends up being the last immortal, because there can be only one, is going to inherit all of the power that these immortals have been sharing throughout the ages, and it's a pretty big fucking deal.
Yeah. And what's also interesting with what they do here, there are two flashbacks that aren't backstory in terms of, like, pure explanation. Like, they're not just exposition. Like, a lot of them are, here's how he learned he was a Highlander or an immortal. Here's how he... got trained. Here's where, you know, he lost his first love. Here's where he learned to hate the Kurgan, you know, all of that stuff. And then there are these two amazing character bits. One, he's in Nazi Germany, or the Nazis are invading wherever they are. They don't quite set it up, but the little girl, again, this is one of those problems. Little girl speaks English, but they're fighting Nazis, and the Nazis never actually invaded on land in the UK. So they're somewhere. But the little girl ends up growing old with him and being his secretary and being a woman you can tell is in love with him. But also doesn't cross that line because she respects the fact that this has been her kind of surrogate father. The same time,
if he's a vampire, she's his familiar. Like, it's just, this really interesting sort of relationship.
And she's very protective of him. And that whole relationship is great. Him and Rachel, I think her name is, that great little, subplot is wonderful. And then there is one purely for humor's sake, which is probably one of my favorite parts of the movie, in which Connor has gotten very, very drunk and accidentally insulted some lord's wife, and the lord has demanded a duel so he can murder him, and he can't kill him.
Yeah.
And of course Connor is too drunk to really realize what's going on. He doesn't even know who's trying to kill him at first, And so he doesn't know that he's supposed to play dead for a while. And so the Lord keeps killing him over and over again and can't get it right.
The Lord, who looks strikingly like Vincent Cassell, but is not, in fact, Vincent Cassell.
Is not Vincent Cassell. A guy who gets so angry that he murders his own assistant.
Yes.
Because he cannot kill Connor McLeod. And it's a great piece of comedy that really kind of drives home that this is not all, you know, grim, dark fantasy, like that these guys are real and have lives and do stupid shit. And I love this particular scene. I think it's a perfect scene of delightful comedy in the middle of an otherwise really dark movie. I mean, especially if you consider, you know, we think of Highlander as this kind of great kind of classic fantasy film. It's a bloody fucking movie at times.
Yeah. No, and I mean, right after we see Sean Connery's head get taken off, by the way, his full name in this movie is Juan Sanchez Villalobos Ramirez. We see him not only get stabbed through the heart, but then his head get taken off at the very top of a crumbling tower. Like, it is pretty savage, but actually the scene that really moves me the most about this movie is when we watch the aftermath of that, where Connor McLeod is trying to live a normal sort of pastoral life with his wife, but we watch the years go by and see that he isn't aging and she is, and then he just has to watch her die. And like, that is so tragic to me, like more than anything else that happens in this movie. And it's really actually quite moving.
And Ramirez talks about it and sets it up and is like, you need to leave. Like, you don't want to go through what I went through. And Ramirez is literally talking about something that happened in the 6th century BC. He's talking about something that happened to him 2,100 years before this conversation, and it's still fucking with him.
Yeah. And by the way, we are treated to the idea of this scene in which we ponder the question, who wants to live forever, to the strains of the Queen song, Who Wants to Live Forever? Because the thing we haven't mentioned yet in the entire 45 minutes we've been talking is that the soundtrack was done entirely by Queen. I am immortal. I have inside me blood of kings. Yeah. I have no rival. No man can be my equal. Send me to the future of you all.
And it is fucking awesome. In fact, I love how they came aboard this. They were asked if they would do a song.
One song
by Mulcahy, who, of course, again, he was a music video director, so he had a line in on a bunch of bands and was able to approach them and say, hey, I want to get a song. And they were not really thrilled with what happened on Flash Gordon. Because, you know, Flash Gordon at the time was still thought of as a big bomb, as a turkey. It had not yet gone down in history as, you know, the classic that many of us, a whole generation of us, revere it as. So they were like, we need to see the movie first. And so they watched a rough cut of the movie, went, holy shit, we want to write all of this. So they wrote all the music for it except some score, which was done by Michael Kamen.
Yeah, it's like when you don't have Queen, you have the guy do the fucking music for Die Hard, just standing by before Die Hard even.
Yeah, and he does a version of Who Wants to Live Forever orchestral that's fucking gorgeous.
Yeah, no, I mean, the music in this is insane, and it's one of the rare instances where we talk about a movie, and we of course talk a lot about the alternate universes, not where the movies and the TV show collide, but where alternate versions of the movies we love exist. And usually that's about directors. That's about actors who were offered roles, turned down roles, didn't get it after auditioning, and what that might have looked like. This is one of the rare movies we can talk about the many bands who almost did the soundtrack, because Queen was not the first choice. The first choice was actually David Bowie. And then it went to Sting, and Sting wasn't going to just do the soundtrack. Sting was going to play Connor McLeod. And then it went to Duran Duran. Like, it went through a bunch of big-name bands and then a couple of smaller bands before it got to Queen. And it's entirely because Queen was going to do one song, decided they loved the movie so much that they just kept writing songs for it. And then we get this incredible soundtrack. And we, of course, just talked about Flash Gordon not, you know, a few weeks ago, and how that is an iconic fucking Queen soundtrack. This is right up there with it. And what I love about it,
this or that, You can only have one.
There can be only one?
There can be only one. Mm. Who wins in the There Can Be Only One between the Flash Gordon soundtrack and the Highlander soundtrack?
I plead the fifth, which is that I will just cut my own head off instead of answering that question because that
I
is
honestly
tough.
I take Flash Gordon.
It's maybe, but it's a squeaker.
It is, but I do listen to the Flash Gordon soundtrack a lot, whereas I love this soundtrack and I love a bunch of these songs on it. But typically, I only listen to them in mixes with other Queen. I never pull out the Highlander soundtrack and just rock that out.
Well, one of the problems with just pulling out the Highlander soundtrack is there are a number of songs on the soundtrack that are in the movie that aren't on the soundtrack. Queen has a cover of New York, New York in this movie.
Yes.
That isn't anywhere.
It's a crazy cover, too. Like, that cover is just really bonkers.
Yeah.
That was really one of those where they were just kind of having fun and messing around. And is It's a Kind of Magic in Highlander?
I can't recall sure.
I was listening for it and I could never find it. So I don't know if
It would make sense because Mulcahy directed the video.
He
for
did.
It's a Kind of Magic.
And there are two references to it. That's the line with the little girl. Like when the little girl first asks him, why didn't he kill you when he shot you? And he says, it's a kind of magic. And it's a kind of magic's the last thing he says to her when he's going out to battle the Kurgan.
There's that. And then there's that moment where Ramirez is like, throughout all time, what I found myself coming back to again and again was fat bottom girls. And it's like, okay, now you're just like, you're just really wedging these references in, guys. It's unnecessary.
That's not true.
It's not? Okay, maybe I watched a different cut. I watched the Renegade cut.
The Renegade cut.
That damn crime dog is after me again. By the way, let's think about this for a second.
Jess's crime dog thing is really fucking with you,
isn't it? It's opening up so many weird wrinkles in my brain, one of which being, so Sean Connery, of course, famous for being the first actor to play James Bond on screen. James Bond is a character that's existed since 1962, and they're still making movies today about this character who is still James Bond. So either the theory that James Bond is a title and not a name, alternately, James Bond's an immortal, guys. James Bond is a fucking Highlander. And that's kind of an
immortal,
awesome idea,
not
too.
Highlander. Highlander is just where he came from.
Well, if the first actor to play him was actually a Scotsman, he could technically be a Highlander. And I kind of love the idea of living in a world where James Bond, 007, British intelligence secret weapon, is in fact an immortal who can't be killed unless someone chops his head off. Because, yeah, no, that's a great coming together. The Venn diagram of nerd in that situation is almost more than I can handle, as is the final fight between the Kurgan and MacLeod in this movie, which takes place at Silver Cup Studios in Queens, where they essentially rip down Silver Cup Studios. It's Armageddon by the time this fucking thing is over.
Oh, yeah. Well, because there's so much there's so much quickening in both of them at this point. Because they've literally, between the two of them, they have killed every other immortal in the world. Or have the souls of the guys who did that. And this ending is just, the sword fight's epic. It's really well done. It's so gorgeously shot. It's inspired by a bunch of the same 70s martial arts movies that you would see Tarantino inspired by in Kill Bill. In fact, there's a couple shots in here that are very similar to the second half of the sequence with the crazy 88s.
Sure.
And then, of course, when the Kurgan finally loses his head, what happens after that is so fucking crazy and so big. It's so high concept that that the movie just takes on a whole different dimension at that point. The effects in this sequence of the movie are not great.
They don't hold up.
There's actually of all the stuff where it's like, okay, I see he didn't have a lot to do all these spirits and all that. You see similar bits in other movies of the time, like Poltergeist or, God, I'm blanking on the other Toby Hooper film, Life Force. you see effects like that in those, but those were huge budget movies. This doesn't. But there's a bit when Christopher Lambert is hoisted into the air during the quickening. You see the fucking wires.
And the close-up of the wires. And I'll say this. The movie Ghost has more believable, like, demon creatures than I expected Swayze to just show up and be like, you're dead, Kurgan. And then all of these ghosts show up. Like, it's that flimsy.
Yeah. It's goofy, but...
It's a kind of poor magic.
The ideas in that are so good. And then when you find out what the prize is, it's really kind of fucking neat and interesting, but also tragic in its own way. Like, these guys have fought for centuries and positioned themselves to get this great power to be able to reach out and connect with any and all other living things and know what they're thinking and feeling so that you can communicate with them and speak all languages. And you can have children, which you haven't been able to have, and grow old and die with someone, which is great. But you've lived this long so that you can die without having to get your head cut off. Like, that's the prize. Congratulations. You don't have to get decapitated.
The bad news, you got to be in Highlander 2. So sorry. Thank you for playing. Would you like this gold-plated Dalmatian instead? Yeah, no, it's unfortunate when you find out what the prize is. But you're right. It has that extra level of tragic to it. And I really like the core concept of Highlander, which is really just if the movie The Duelist was more interesting and fun. Because I'm one of those people, I do not care for Ridley Scott's The Duelist at all. And Gregory Wyden has talked about the fact that that was a big inspiration for The Highlander was Ridley Scott's The Duelist. I just love the idea that you have these beings that walk among us that are immortals, but they're not vampires. They're not hiding out in castles and trying to feed on people to sustain themselves. There is this sort of, there is this competitive, you know, contest going on to be the last one of them. It's strange. It's like this.
But they're not all
of,
competitive. Like, right. Like, there's that great scene where his old buddy shows up, who he hasn't seen in 100 years.
Yeah. His friend Castigere.
Yeah, who's really only in two scenes of the movie. He's in that. He goes gets drunk with Connor and then goes and fights the Kurgan and gets obliterated very quickly and very sadly. But it's a really great moment because you see the camaraderie between these guys who haven't seen each other in 100 years.
Yeah.
And they don't want to kill each other.
No, and then shortly after he takes out Castigere, there's a great scene with the Kurgan confronting McCloud in a church where you can just tell Clancy Brown is having a ball being this giant weirdo creep. And what's the line he has as he's exiting the church?
I've got something to say. It's better to fade out than to fade away.
It's just, and then apparently Clancy Brown.
Burnout
than fade away.
Then fade away.
Apparently Clancy Brown, as huge as he is and being this creepy villain, he came back into the church after the scene and apologized to the priests and the nuns for the things that he'd been saying throughout the scene because he's worried he'd actually offended them. So, you know, this from the guy who the first scene with Sean Connery nearly decapitated him because he got a little overzealous with the sword. Like, I feel like this would have been a fun set to be a part of for sure. And that brings us to the junk food pairing. And speaking of getting obliterated, I feel like the only true way to enjoy the Highlander is with a big glass of Oban. Oban, of course, being it is a single malt Scotch whiskey produced in the Highland region of Scotland. And if you want to feel like you'll live forever, definitely get yourself a glass of. They do Oban in 18 years. They do, right? No.
I don't. They might do. I think they might do an 18. It might actually be like an odd year, like a 17 or a 19. Typically, Oban is a 14.
14, 18, and 32.
They also have what you have had of mine many times is the Oban Distillers Reserve, which we've talked about on the show before. That is great. Although I'm going to, I know, shocker, argue with you just a tiny bit here about your choice. If you're going to drink some scotch while you're watching Highlander, I mean, let's tie it right in. And when Connor McLeod of Clan MacLeod drinks scotch in the movie, he drinks Glenmorangie. And he calls for Glenmorangie in the film. And since I love Glenmorangie, I would definitely, it's one of my brands, I would definitely recommend a nice Glenmorangie. If you're not a big scotch person, if you're like, you know, I don't get scotch like everyone else, I recommend the Glenmorangie Nectar d'Or. So check that out. That is aged in a Chardonnay cask, so it has a nice sweet finish. I like calling it scotch with training wheels. It's for the person who would like to get into scotch but not ready to move up to the big scotches yet. It is a nice sweet, nice starter scotch that will help you develop the taste for scotch, and then you will move on. And moving on through the Glenmorangie line is also a great way to go. They've got four or five different aged casks. And then I love Glenmorangie 18. Glenmorangie 18 is a wonderful 18-year-old scotch.
See, I'm just imagining Christopher Lambert in a bar calling out for Glenmorangie, like, I'm looking for Glenmorangie. He's the guy that's teaching you to have this flawless Scottish accent. Too bad it didn't work out. No, that's actually far better. I forgot that he actually specifically calls out.
Yeah.
Glenmorangie being another of the Highland Scotches. So no, for sure. Definitely do Glenmorangie. 1,000%. And that's going to do it for this week's episode. Thank you guys not only for listening, but thank you for reminding us that we had not yet covered Highlander and voicing on Twitter, on Facebook, how much you wanted us to do it and moving it up there with the votes. So January is closing out well with not one, but two Sean Connery films. So I'm super excited about that. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Massawyrm, MassawyrM. And until the end of the month, I can't believe I forgot to mention this the last two episodes. Till the end of the month, till the end of January, Sea of Rust is available on your Kindle for only $1.99. That's $2. $2 for 400 pages of robot v. robot action. So you can find the book there. Oh, and Doctor Strange right now is on Netflix. So if you've got Netflix and you're like, I need some more Cargill in my life, hey, Doctor Strange is there.
Nice. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And of course, again, if this show really does it for you, if it really really makes you lose your head, go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and you will hear more jokes like that and better ones as well, and a lot of bonus content there. And you guys are directly supporting the show, making sure we can keep the lights on and keep doing this because we do love doing it so much. So thank you so much for all of your support. But for now, I'm going to bid you adieu and remind you that here we are, born to be Burger Kings. We are the princes of the universe.